What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Car Rittenhouse, the armed white teenager whose mother drove him from Illinois to Wisconsin to allegedly protect local businesses from anti-racism protesters in Kenosha, whereupon he shot and killed two people and injured another, has been acquitted of all charges. The article you're about to hear has been written by Cass Mudd, a professor of international affairs at the University of Georgia in the United States, and the author of the book The Far Right Today. The piece is titled, Kyle Rittenhouse Has Walked Free, Now It's Open Season on Protesters. Kyle Rittenhouse, the armed white teenager whose mother drove him from Illinois to Wisconsin to allegedly protect local businesses from anti-racism protesters in Kenosha, Wisconsin, whereupon he shot and killed two people and injured another, has been acquitted of all charges. I don't think anyone who has followed the trial even casually will be surprised by this verdict. After the various antics by the elected judge, which seemed to indicate where his sympathies lay, and the fact that the prosecution asked the jurors to consider charges lesser than murder, the writing was on the wall. I do not want to discuss the legal particulars of the verdict. It is clear that the prosecution made many mistakes and got little to no leeway from the judge, unlike the defense team. Moreover, we know that self-defense, often better known as vigilantism, is legally protected and highly racialized in this country. Think of the acquittal of George Zimmerman, of the killing of Trayvon Martin in 2013. In essence, the Rittenhouse ruling has created a kind of stand-your-ground law for the whole country. White people now have the apparent right to travel around the country heavily armed and use violence to protect the country from whatever and whoever they believe to be threatening it. Given the feverish paranoia and racism that has captured a sizable minority of white people in the United States these days, this is a recipe for disaster. In the coming hours and days, many media outlets will eagerly await riots or other potentially violent reactions from the other side, from the anti-racists and progressives of all colors and races who are disturbed by this verdict and use the existence of those riots, if they occur, to push a misguided both sides frame. If there is protest or rioting, don't expect the police to be as courteous and supportive as they were towards Kyle Rittenhouse and his far-right buddies. The most worrying effect of this court verdict may be this: giving right-wing vigilantes a legal precedent to take up arms against anyone they consider a threat, which pretty much runs from anti-fascists to so-called Renos, or Republicans in name only, and includes almost all people of color, means it is now open hunting season on progressive protesters. Don't get me wrong. This ruling alone did not start this kind of lopsided law and order. It is just the latest in a centuries-old American tradition of protecting white terror and vigilantism. Civil rights demonstrations in the 1960s, particularly but not exclusively in the South, were not just denied police protection. The demonstrators were actually attacked and abused by the police. That was also the case at many Black Lives Matter demonstrations last year. A Boston Globe investigation found that between George Floyd's death on 25th of May 2020 and 30th of September 2021, vehicles drove into protests at least 139 times, injuring at least 100 people. In fewer than half of the cases, the driver was charged, and only four drivers have been convicted of a felony. Moreover, in response to these attacks, Republican legislators have proposed laws to protect the drivers from legal action in case they hit a protester. Florida, Iowa, and Oklahoma have already passed such laws. It takes courage to publicly protest in any situation, particularly when protesting state powers. Now, protesters in the United States will have to fear not only police brutality, but an emboldened and violent far right, fired up by the Republican Party and the broader right-wing media, and protected by the local legal system. All of this comes at a crucial point in U.S. democracy. From Georgia to Wisconsin, the Republican Party is attacking the electoral system, while their supporters are terrorizing poll workers and those signing up to be poll workers in the next elections. In the event that Democrats win important elections in conservative states in 2022, think Stacey Abrams in Georgia or Beto O'Rourke in Texas, there is a big chance that these results will be contested and judged by highly partisan forces protected by state politicians. Similarly, should President Joe Biden or another Democrat win the 2024 presidential election, the result would again be challenged in conservative states. But this time, independent poll workers could be absent or outnumbered, and the few Republicans who withstood Donald Trump's pressure in 2020 will have been replaced or have fallen in line. At that point, Democrats, and indeed all Democratic-minded citizens, will have to go into the streets to protest. They will confront an alliance of heavily armed civilians and police and National Guard who can attack protesters with effective immunity. Remember, Kyle Rittenhouse has just been acquitted after killing two people and injuring a third person at a protest. In my home country, the Netherlands, we have a saying that is used regularly in political discussions. Democracy is not for scared people. Most of the time when it is used, we mean that democracy is not for people who are afraid of change or of critique. In the United States, in the wake of today's verdict, this saying has become both more real and more sinister.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, our program aims to address the most important issues in the South Asian region, what is going on, who are the key actors involved, what are the people saying, and how are the issues changing the future. All of this will be answered with the help of our team of experts and guests, so stay tuned.
In this episode of The Subcontinent, we will take a look at the shared elements of the cultural and linguistic identity of Iran and the subcontinent. We will also examine the roots of the recent conflicts between Muslims and Hindus in the subcontinent that have been continuously increasing ever since the BJP took power in India.
November 9th was the birth anniversary of a man who was able to awaken the Islamic philosophy in the minds of Muslims across the subcontinent. Poet, philosopher, politician, and Muslim Pakistani thinker Allama Iqbal Lahori was well versed in literature, politics, and philosophy. His Persian and Urdu poems have also received worldwide acclaim. Iqbal was a thinker with the pain and the concerns of Muslims on his mind. He used his words and thoughts to convey the secrets of the self to his fellow men in his own time and beyond. A lesson that seems more vital for Muslims to learn today, especially in this chaotic modern world.
Allama Muhammad Iqbal was born on November 9, 1877, in Sialkot, in the Punjab province of Pakistan. He was named Pakistan's national poet and was always making efforts to inform the population and free them from the bonds of colonialism. One of the greatest concerns of Allama Iqbal was fortifying the belief of the nations of East in their own capabilities and creating unity among the Muslims of the world. He was one of the critics of the westernization of Eastern societies. In his lasting poems, many of which are in Persian, he has emphasized the importance of the return to self to his listeners.
The form of existence is an effect of the self. Everything you see is a secret of the self. When the self awoke to consciousness, it revealed the universe of thought. 100 words are hidden in its essence. Self-affirmation brings not self to light. By the self, the seed of opposition is sown in the world. It imagines itself to be other than itself, and it makes from itself the forms of others.
Iqbal believed that the poverty and the divide between East and West had occurred because of blind imitation of Western superficial life, instead of learning from their technological and scientific advancements and their success in the industry. On the other hand, he had understood that the basis and root of the East and Muslim world are humanism. That is why he saw it necessary to turn the attention of the Islamic world to this matter and has made profound points in this regard through his works. The language of choice for Iqbal in his poems is the language of the past poets of Iran and the subcontinent, a language that has flourished for around 9 centuries in this vast land and has left treasures of literary importance beyond to bring delight for generations to come.
Iran and the subcontinent have enjoyed extended ties in culture, language, religion, art, trade, and industry over the years. The origin of these ties can be traced back to the Indo-Aryan migration across the Iranian plateau. Back then, the combination of these two groups made up the Indo-Iranian branch, and they shared the same language and religion and were considered the same race. As time passed, these two nations divided into two groups, each residing in a new area, and so their ways of life and dispositions changed. However, the shared elements in their language and ethnic and culture never truly ruptured, and after several decades, a new Persian Hindu Islamic civilization was born.
Before the English language made its way to the subcontinent, hundreds of languages and dialects have existed throughout the centuries, and among them, Persian was considered to be the language of education, science, and bureaucracy. Through the decades, India was not only the center of the Sanskrit cosmopolis, but had it also become part of the extra-regional Persian world and was influenced by the Persian language and culture. As Richard M. Eaton has expressed in his book India in the Persianate Age, Not only did India accept the Persian language, but it was also quick to become a center for the manufacture of Persian culture. But in the 19th century, and with the expansion of the East India Company and the beginning of British colonialism in India, the English language gradually replaced Persian. In that time, learning English had become a path to success, and Indians who were looking to thrive and advance were forced to let go of their own culture, the Persian and Sanskrit culture, and become Englishmen. An exchange that would see the people of the subcontinent stray far from the rich culture of their predecessors.
Had the British not come into India in the 1800s, you would not need an interpreter because we all used to speak Farsi. The court language for 600 years in India was Farsi.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Gohar Gilani, an author and journalist. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Gilani.
Thank you for having me in your show. Thank you very much.
As you know, November 9th is the birthday of Allama Iqbal Lahori. So what effect did the philosophy and thought of this great thinker have on the self-confidence and the unity of Muslims around the subcontinent?
Well, you know that in the 20th century, there were several individuals, who played a key role in the revival and also the reform of Islam. And Allama Iqbal, who is popularly known as Allama Iqbal in South Asia, and Iqbal Lahori in Persia, in Iran. So he is one among those intellectual contributors in that sense. He wanted to emulate some of those to bring Muslims, especially at that time there was turbulence in South Asia. There was British colonialism. The larger India was under British control. And this man, Allama Iqbal, then had several, kind of correspondences with Muhammad Ali Jinnah. And then, the rest of the history, this was also a period when there was a sort of decline in the Muslim world. And this was the beginning of the British colonial era. And it was at its peak, actually. So in that sense, the role that Allama Iqbal played through his poetry and through his, work, body of work, and it could appeal to a large section of society, which included not only the youth, but also the children and also intellectual thinkers. So in that sense, he has played a significant role as far as Muslim unity and strength is concerned.
Mr. Gilani, we know that Iqbal Lahori has many poems in Persian. I wanted to see why was he so interested in the Persian language and literature, and what was the influence of Iranian poets and thinkers on his thoughts and works?
Well, interestingly, if you see his work at that time, this was the generation of our grandparents. He was born when 20 years after the mutiny, 1857 mutiny that took place against the British rulers. So Iqbal, Allama Iqbal, was born in 1877. As I said, at that time, there was a lot of influence also of Persian language in this entire region. And interestingly, also the part I come from, Kashmir, which is also referred to as Iran-e-Saghir, prototype of Iran. There was a lot of influence of Central Asia. And if you go back like 600, 700 years and you talk about Mir Sayyid Ali Hamdani, who came to Kashmir thrice, along with his 700 companions, which are known as Sadat. And in that sense, the influence of Persian language, it was also a court language in the Mughal era. And that language was part and parcel of the entire social fabric. It was a language which was spoken by our, grandparents' generation. And people from that era also used to attend Maulud gatherings. And also in mosques, there were a lot of manqabat and noha. All of that was written in Persian language. It is sort of an irony that right now, this generation of ours does not have that kind of access to Persian language as people like Allama Iqbal had. So there was a Persian language was kind of a bridge that connected this part of the world to the Iranian civilization. So there was that's why we see a lot of poems like Saki Nama, in which there is a lot of focus on economic awakening of the Kashmiri people, which Iqbal wrote in one of the Mughal gardens called the Nishad Gardens. So you see, in that era, all the poets and all the writers from the subcontinent, the larger Indian subcontinent, they had a huge influence of the Persian language.
Mr. Gilani, we could say that with the beginning of British colonization and depersonalization of the language in this region, the linguistic connection that existed for centuries between Iran and the Indian subcontinent was lost. What effect does this have on the separation of subcontinent culture from its ancient history and cultural heritage?
I would say the losses are huge. If you allow me to go back a little, it was not only of the rise of British colonialism, but in Europe we saw at the same time there was European fascism and Muslim power was kind of in on a decline, and the kind of role that Allama Iqbal at that time played with his kind of worldview and what he gained from his experiences and his long travels to Europe and his interaction with the outside Western world. So that became a kind of a bridge, and people started getting connected to it. And slowly and gradually, when Persian language got removed from the courts, from the main linguistic assets, so this automatically meant that whatever role as a bridge it played between the Iranian civilization and between the Muslim world and the people living in this part of the world, the Muslims of this world, so that connection got lost, and it kind of if you can use the word, it orphaned people of this land to this beautiful language, and through which other avenues and other windows were opened. So in that sense, it has been a huge literary loss. It has been huge in terms of civilizational kind of an assault by removing that language from the official, as an official language, and introducing other languages which people do consider were alien to them, because with this language there was an emotional attachment, and that's why I'm saying that it has been people of this region have been orphaned of a wonderful language.
Thank you, Mr. Gilani. Thank you for being on the program.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
Since mid-October, Bangladesh has witnessed an abrupt increase in religious violence. These conflicts started with the Hindu religious celebrations after a post surfaced on social media in which the holy book of Quran was subject to disrespect in a Hindu palace of worship. This incident led to extreme violence and incineration of Hindu prayer houses, and was then met with retaliatory attacks against Muslims by Hindu extremists. A fire that burnt all the way across to Bangladesh and spread to a few other cities in India.
A spark that led to a devastating flame. At the time of the sacred Hindu festival of Durga Puja, a menacing picture in which the holy book of Muslims, the Quran, was disrespected, circled social media platforms and led to the outrage of the 164 million Muslim majorities in Bangladesh. The ensuing rage in a series of violent retaliatory actions by both sides led to a few deaths and left hundreds injured in its wake. Mosques and temples were burned down one after another, continuing all the way to India. Both sides accused the governments. Some were aiming their dissent at the secular government of Sheikh Hasina Wazid and her silence against the disrespect by the Hindu minority that comprises 9% of the population. On the other hand, the extremist Modi government is accused of spreading anti-Islam policies in the country, which has to power a new wave of extremist groups in India. Experts have warned that if India and Bangladesh do not take immediate action to de-escalate the violence, the memories of killings from previous decades could come to life again.
Divide and conquer is the fundamental policy of the British Empire's colonization of the subcontinent and the source of all the pessimism and contradiction between India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Although historical evidence proves that the various societies in the Indian subcontinent have never experienced absolute unity before the colonization, and there have never been any real distinguishing characteristics between the religions in the area, the differences have remained rather vague. But the division that was established by the colonialist masters eventually led to the segmentation of the subcontinent in 1947 according to religious differences, a festering wound caused by the hypocrisy of colonialism that the people of the subcontinent still suffer from every day.
History has proven that whatever takes place in India, as the largest country in South Asia, will create a significant ripple effect in the entire region. Bangladesh, with its ties during its 50 years of independence, has significant bilateral ties with India, along with their historic and cultural bonds. India was very helpful during the Bangladeshi fight for independence against Pakistan in 1971. This shared history and common historic bitterness of both states towards Pakistan have brought the two countries close and helped strengthen the bilateral ties between the countries through decades of cooperation. In the past decade, the bilateral agreement in 2015, aimed at resolving 70-year-old border conflicts, has fortified relations between the two nations more than ever. But there is a darker side to this relationship. With the rise of the extremist BJP in India, the country is on a declining path towards Hindu nationalism. This change in approach has had an undeniable impact on Indian foreign policy. Discriminatory policies implemented by the Indian government over the past few years, such as the citizenship law against Muslims, have negatively influenced the feeling of unity between India and its neighboring Muslim countries. India's gradual transformation to an ultra-nationalist state has been triggered by the Hindutva policy, or Hindu First policy. It is an obvious threat to bilateral ties between India and Bangladesh, brought about by strong ties between the leadership and the relations between the people of the two countries.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Roshan Mohammad Saleh, an editor at the British Muslim news website Five Pillars. Now, Mr. Saleh, welcome to the program, first of all. Recently, tensions between Hindus and Muslims in Bangladesh and India have intensified, and some have been killed and injured. What is the main root of violence in this region?
I think there's always been tensions historically in that region, in the subcontinent. But I think the latest round of violence basically started when social media rumors circulated about a Quran being desecrated in Western Bangladesh. And that obviously led to a lot of anger. And then there were attacks on Hindus. I think people did die, unfortunately, in those attacks. So things just kind of spiraled out of control to a certain extent. And then you have the so-called tit-for-tat attacks across the border in India. But I think generally we can say that region, there have been tensions historically, especially since partition, when the British Empire, you know, basically ran away from India. And, you know, you had lots of communal violence in 1947. Then you had the secession of Bangladesh, East Pakistan from West Pakistan. That led to, you know, tensions as well, because India helped Bangladesh achieve its independence. And then most recently, you have the rise of Hindu nationalism, embodied by the BJP ruling regime in India and its leader, Modi. And of course, there's this open wound, which is Kashmir. So I think historically, the region has been a bit of a tinderbox, but it's been exacerbated lately by the rise of Hindu nationalism.
Now, Mr. Saleh, Hindus are a religious minority in Bangladesh, and Muslims in India have almost the same situation. And what is the relationship, if there is any, between the recent religious violence in Bangladesh and India?
I think there's no doubt that there is discrimination against minorities in both countries, but I do think it's a little bit misleading to compare India directly with Bangladesh. Bangladesh, I mean, it prides itself on being a secular state where everyone is equal under the law. In practice, the Hindu community have complained about discrimination, and I think some discrimination has taken place. But I don't think it's as systematic as it is in India, where you have a ruling regime which is discriminating against Muslims in the law, for example, through legislation, and is also encouraging its supporters to attack Muslims, where there is no redress whatsoever for Muslims. Whereas in Bangladesh, the authorities are now arresting people, arresting Muslims, in effect, for attacks on Hindus. I doubt if the same thing is going to happen in India, because you have this kind of open season on Muslims there, which is encouraged at the highest levels of the Indian regime.
So, Mr. Saleh, who benefits from this religious strife and religious violence in the subcontinent? Who is the main winner and loser of this bloody violence?
Well, I think no doubt the biggest losers are people of the region. The Muslims of Pakistan, the Hindus of India, the Muslims of Bangladesh, the Hindus of Bangladesh, the Muslims of India. You know, it ultimately doesn't suit any of them, and everyone loses with this constant tension and, you know, war footing that these countries are on to a certain extent. You have a nuclear powered or a nuclear, you know, a nuclear India and a nuclear Pakistan. I think who benefits? I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that the Americans would like to keep the subcontinent divided. They don't want Pakistan and India becoming friends, and they kind of have relations and influence over both sides, and I'm sure they're inspiring some of this tension. We also have Israel, of course. Israel does not want a Muslim nation.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Saleh for his precious time, knowledge, and insight. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Salman Said says, since 70s till 90s, 75k Lakh Kashmiri Muslims lost their lives in two nation conflicts in 25 years, and many women were also raped. Kashmiri Hindus in 1990 died in hundreds, and others had to leave, and the reason was the government and political issues, not a particular community's ideology. Mayak Pandey says, in this match we have to forget all our internal conflicts and just support our nation. Firstly, we all are Indians, and then we are Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, Christians, Buddhists, and so on. Anwar Hossain says, the conflicts between different religious groups, especially Hindu and Muslims, in Indian subcontinent was the divide and rule policy of the British colonialists. But we were so stupid to understand that. This divide and rule policy was so smoothly planned that we were busy fighting each other, hate each other, while they were ruling and looting us in every possible way.
And that was our episode about the shared elements of the cultural and linguistic identity of Iran and the subcontinent, and also the sudden increase in religious violence in Bangladesh. We shall meet again next week, so till then, take care.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight. In March 2010, with Tea Party activists protesting loudly in the hallways of Capitol Hill and the political wind in their faces, 34 House Democrats, including Representative Stephen Lynch of Massachusetts, broke with their president to vote against passage of the Affordable Care Act. The news analysis you're about to hear has been written by Jonathan Wiseman, who is congressional correspondent and a veteran New York Times journalist. The piece is titled, Painful Changes in Society Ease Passage of Bold Safety Net Measures. March 2010, with Tea Party activists protesting loudly in the hallways of Capitol Hill and the political wind in their faces, 34 House Democrats, including Representative Stephen Lynch of Massachusetts, broke with their president to vote against passage of the Affordable Care Act. It was not enough to kill the bill, but more than enough to register deep concerns about its reach in American society and its potential impact on the midterm elections. On Friday, 19th of November 2021, Stephen Lynch and every other Democrat but one cast votes for about $2 trillion in spending on social welfare and climate change programs that arguably go much further than the health law, further, in fact, than any government intervention in half a century. And the concerns that peeled so many Democrats away from the health measure more than a decade ago were hardly in evidence, at least on their side of the aisle. I've served a couple of times in the minority, a couple of times in the majority, said Mr. Lynch, the last remaining House Democrat who voted against Barack Obama's signature domestic achievement. I've got a better sense of time and how these moments are rare when you can seize on something and make real change. The political and economic shifts in the United States in the decade between the first vote and the second may explain how a party still divided could unite around legislation of such sweep. The worst public health crisis in a century laid bare economic stagnation in the middle class and the soaring wealth of the super rich in America. The recovery from the coronavirus crisis is still held back by childcare costs and poor educational access that have kept parents home instead of working. Searing heat waves, record wildfires, and waves battering hurricanes have underlined the reality of climate change. And the killings of black men and women, captured on video and spread instantly around the world, raise awareness of racial injustice and inequality, just as new generation of progressives was rising up in the Democratic Party. I've always said, courage comes out of crisis, said Representative Pramila Jayapal, Democrat of Washington and the leader of the nearly 100-member Congressional Progressive Caucus. You just couldn't ignore this stuff anymore. It was intolerable to watch. Those forces appeared to unite Democrats as they made their way to the Capitol to vote. There were no shouts from angry opponents like the ones that greeted Democrats in 2010 as they prepared to approve the Affordable Care Act. The main barrier to passage was an 8-hour speech by the House Republican leader, Representative Kevin McCarthy of California. Beyond the chamber, the only activists in evidence were a small clutch of supporters singing old union songs and someone dressed like the Build Back Better Act, modeled after the bill in the old Schoolhouse Rock video. The social safety net and climate bill still must navigate a tortuous road through the evenly divided Senate, where a single defection would bring it down. If it is able to clear that chamber, it most likely will have to go back to the House for a final vote, devoid of some of its items that drew Democrats to support it on Friday. But if it is enacted, it will touch virtually every American life, from birth to death, akin to Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal or Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society. Its generous subsidies for childcare and universal pre-kindergarten are designed to lift the struggling working class into a less precarious economic position. Ample housing support, more higher education aid, and worker training programs in the bill would reach well into the middle class. Home and community health care, a new hearing benefit for Medicare, and price controls for prescription drugs would ease the lives of older Americans. All of that could reasonably be described as big government excess, and Republicans have made that case repeatedly for months. The scope and cost of the bill, if anything, is understated by its roughly $2 trillion price tag, because Democrats kept the cost down by phasing in some measures and arbitrarily ending others well before the expiration of the bill's 10-year window, some after a single year. In all, according to the Committee for a Reasonable Budget, if the entire Build Back Better Act were made permanent, the 10-year cost would be $4.9 trillion, which would exceed the inflation-adjusted 4-year cost of the Second World War, as Kevin McCarthy charged repeatedly over 8 hours. Yet a combined assault by business organizations like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, their political operatives at groups like American Action Network, and the intense focus on the Republican Party against what they call socialist early education, crippling tax increases and dangerous limitations on drug companies was not enough to peel away even 4 House Democrats, the bare minimum that would have been needed to defeat the legislation. Competitive races next year will test whether voters embrace Republicans' grim view of the package or Democrats' belief that they are delivering vital programs that will be broadly appealing. Representative Tim Ryan, a Democrat from the working class region of Ohio, who is running for an open Senate seat, said Republicans have dug themselves a political hole by railing against the bill. They're getting themselves in a position where they're putting themselves against universal preschool. They're putting themselves against controlling childcare costs for people, putting themselves on the other side of a tax cut for families, Mr. Ryan said. You know, people have been screaming socialism for a long time, and Roosevelt got elected 4 times. The social welfare and climate bill is not yet law, but to have gotten it even this far was a prodigious feat, and what that probably happened only because of the societal and economic changes that preceded it, Democrats from across the spectrum of their party say. Look at the millennials in my district, who can't afford a house, who can't afford to pay back their student loans, who can't even dream about living their lives their parents lived, Representative John B. Larson of Connecticut, a veteran Democrat, said, You can't tell people they're doing better than they are. And as society has changed, so has the Democratic Party. Representative Jamal Bowman's New York district stretches from the wealthy suburb of Scarsdale to the tougher streets of Mount Vernon, and for 32 years was represented by white establishment Democrat Elliot Engel. Jamal Bowman, a progressive black man who defeated Mr. Engel in a Democratic primary last year, said his constituents acknowledge wealth inequality and income stagnation in their midst, in part because he won't let them deny it. If they try to look the other way, they really can't, Mr. Bowman said, and they know that whether it's through government or private industry or both, we have to do more to close the inequality gap. Republicans are still betting that voters will fixate on the spectacle of a Democratic president struggling for months to unite his divided majority around his agenda. They argue that the chaotic and deadly withdrawal from Afghanistan, rising inflation, and unsteady economic growth have only added to a sense that the country is in a drift, and say they're not about to allow Democrats to use the society, the social safety net bill, to distract from these concerns. We have a supply chain crisis that continues to rage on, exacerbating the skyrocketing prices and scarcity of goods our citizens are experiencing, the House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy said on Thursday. And ask yourself this, what has this chamber done, especially this week, to alleviate any of these pressures on our fellow citizens, the people we were sent here to represent? The answer is absolutely nothing. Passage of the bill, Republicans say, will only stoke inflation, force the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates, and create stagflation, the combination of stagnant economic growth and rising prices that doomed Jimmy Carter's presidency. Democrats contend that their policies will offer real relief. Economic trends indicate a need for targeted assistance to the working and middle class, and it would be paid for largely by the richest Americans and largest corporations. In 2010, a moderate Democrat was socially liberal on issues like abortion and immigration, but fiscally conservative on government spending, and many of them voted against the Affordable Care Act. Today, a new brand of Democrats have emerged who are fiscally populist, but more circumspect on progressive social causes like immigration, defunding police forces, and pressing responses to racial injustice. They voted for the bill on Friday. Republicans warn that Democrats will pay a steep political price for doing so. They point to the accelerating pace of retirement announcements, the latest coming on Thursday, 18th of November, from Representative G.K. Butterfield, a senior black Democrat from North Carolina, who would face a difficult re-election if a Republican gerrymandering district map for 2022 passes court muster. Who can blame these Democrats for retiring? Kevin McCarthy asked, almost taunting them before the vote. They see the writing on the wall, and they know this reconciliation bill will be the end of their Democrat majority, and for many, their congressional careers. Mr. Butterfield, who noted he was 74 years old, said on Thursday night that he appreciated Kevin McCarthy's sense of humor. Mr. Cartwright, who in 2012 unseated a fellow Democrat in northeastern Pennsylvania because he had voted against the health law, said he did not fear the Republican attacks to come. Republicans have opposed things that help ordinary working people for generation after generation after generation, he said. They spoke of downfall of civilization when Franklin Delano Roosevelt came up with Social Security.
In the modern era, man has reached ever new technological heights unprecedented in history. We can now communicate and interact with those halfway around the world with ease, manage workloads with a click of a finger, or access information and news in a matter of seconds. Perhaps a world without electronic technology would be unimaginable. But this miraculous blessing has a very, very dark and toxic underbelly. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. The electronic technology we are so dependent on creates waste unseen in the Earth's history. Every year, up to 50 million tons of electronic waste, computers, television sets, mobile phones, and household appliances are thrown away by consumers in the developed countries. 75% of this waste disappears from the legal recycling circuit, much of it dumped illegally in the third world. Stay with us as this week's documentary spans the world to reveal how greed and corruption are ruining the globe's legal recycling systems, damaging the environment, creating security risks, and endangering human health.
We produce up to 50 million tons of e-waste every single year, and our discarded appliances increasingly end up in places like this dump site in Africa. We first came here 3 years ago, while risking serious health problems such as cancer and brain damage. Since then, the situation has worsened dramatically. The amount of e-waste coming into Africa has almost doubled. And also in Europe, South America, and Asia, the discarded symbols of our modern lifestyle are corroding landscapes and poisoning the soil, water, and air.
It's a crime. I mean, this is a crime of mammoth proportions.
E-waste trafficking is huge and said to be bigger than the drugs trade. Even though the export of e-waste has been banned for more than 30 years, thousands of e-waste containers cross the oceans every year. And the toxic tide is set to rise even further, because in spite of the crisis, the sale of electronics is booming and emerging markets are coming on board. All contribute to a growing mountain of e-waste to which we can no longer turn a blind eye.
It's like a doctor looking at a patient who's bleeding profusely and saying, oh, it's not so bad. When I hear people like that, I say, just go. Just take a plane and go look for yourself and tell me that's not a problem.
All over the world, law enforcement, environmental activists, customs officials, and undercover investigators are fighting to stop the traffickers.
Para ese tipo de personas, el futuro no cuenta. Lo que cuenta es el beneficio inmediato.
The battle is difficult to win because of the huge profits to be made and the corruption involved.
C'est tout un système de montage avec des sociétés écrans. Là, on peut parler de système mafieux.
Can we stop the toxic tide before it is too late? Mike Nane is a Ghanaian environmental journalist and activist. He has made it his personal mission to stop the influx of e-waste to his country. He has discovered that many of the computers dumped here still bear the names of their original owners in Europe and the US.
I'm looking for the asset tags or the property tags. Yes, it gives a lot of indication and provide a clue as to who owned it, who used it.
Mike told me that he had a plan. He wanted to take his collection of tags on a journey of investigation.
The idea is to take these things back to the previous owners, the original owners. And these are e-waste that belong to people in the UK. I'll ask them questions as to how these things got to Ghana, if they have any idea. Somebody has to pay for these things because the environmental and health consequences are enormous. They are killing people here. They should be responsible.
Mike is taking several pieces of e-waste to the UK. The first one originally belonged to Leeds City Council.
Dear Mr. Councillor, my name is Mike Anan. I would like to come and see you to show you what I found and to investigate how your discarded computer equipment found its way to Ghana.
moment that I have been waiting for to listen to their side of the story.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Pleased to meet you. Council Leader Blackburn. If you want to come this way with me.
Okay. I collect the arson tax of some of the e-waste that gets dumped in Ghana.
Royal College of Nursing, yes. HMS Customs at Thames Valley.
South Bank University.
South Bank University, that's in London. So you've got a fair spread of England, you know.
Let me show you the place where I found this equipment.
This is where I keep the e-waste. They have asset tags or property tags. You know, when you look at this, for instance, it says Leeds City Council. It should have been disposed of in that city of Leeds.
Terrible, huh? Terrible. Yeah, not acceptable at all. Is this the same all over Africa, or is there specific parts of Africa where we're having problems with?
We have Nigeria and, of course, Ghana.
Mm.
Yeah, these two countries are the major countries that receive electronic waste.
We've researched, as far as we can, that particular piece of waste from the serial number they can date it. But, I mean, we're talking 20 years ago, and as I said, at that time, I mean, the ethical, what was thought to be ethical was, we'll recondition them and give them to charities that can't afford their own computers. But I don't think anybody actually thought the thing through, that what happens when it is no longer in use.
The records of the donations no longer exist, so Councillor Blackburn can't tell Mike which computer went to which charity. The trail has gone cold. Mike tries to trace back more of the tags he has found in Ghana.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Anani. I'm trying to reach 212 regarding some recycling issues. Do you have anybody around?
Yeah, at the moment, it's basically two teams who have gone into administration and been taken over by Daisy.
Mm-hmm.
All recyclers involved were closed down or sold on years ago.
This number is for sale. For information, call Ozone. If your inquiry is urgent, please use the
Hello?
The number you have dialed has not been recognized.
After a whole week in the UK trying to trace back the tags, Mike still doesn't know who sent the e-waste to Ghana.
I'm very much disappointed. I have been to several places and the usual excuses has been 20 years or we give them to charity. And I find these excuses rather funny. Yeah, because it doesn't take away the problems, it doesn't take away their complicity, and it doesn't take away the fact that they are to be blamed.
Uncovering the e-waste traffic is not as simple as Mike had expected, but he is determined to continue his investigation. E-waste trafficking has been illegal since 1989, when the Basel Convention was signed, the first international treaty banning the trafficking of any kind of toxic waste. To date, 190 countries have signed it, amongst them China and Ghana. The European Union, too, has written the Basel Convention into its laws, prohibiting the export of e-waste. In other words, all EU waste should be recycled in Europe. A system has been designed. In Europe, when a consumer buys a new appliance, the purchase price includes a recycling levy. For instance, the price of a fridge includes a levy of up to 20 euros. Around 4 billion euros are collected this way in Europe every year. This money is used by the industry to run a system which collects, sorts, transports, and recycles our appliances. That's why we can hand them back for recycling for free when we discard them. Thousands of highly specialized recycling plants have been set up all over Europe. Here, the e-waste is treated without harming the workers or the environment. Professional recyclers can get a whole range of valuable materials out of our discarded appliances. But recyclers all over Europe are complaining that their plants are not running to full capacity. And the European Union estimates that at least two-thirds of European e-waste never make it to an official recycling plant. Spain is one of the worst affected countries. So what's going wrong? Belén Ramos works for OQ, Spain's biggest consumer association.